You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko pō toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnā rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for your Thursday, the 23rd of February. It's Pearl here, your host, and I'm also joined by my producer, Jogai, in the studio. Coming up on the show today, Jogai has a story about a recent New Zealand Herald article that was seen as transphobic. We have Andrew Little back for our weekly chat. Jogai is also speaking to Duncan Grieve about the state of current affairs in New Zealand in light of TV3's new current affairs show, The Project. Our news director, Shemina Smith, has a piece about FAFSWAC, a series of projects happening this week as part of the Auckland Pride Festival. BFM reporter Dylan Kelly also has an interview about a Ports of Auckland collective that has a focus on becoming New Zealand's most sustainable port. If you have any thoughts throughout the show, please get in contact by calling 309 3879 or text in on 5395. I'd love to hear what you have to say about any of the stories we have on the show today.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So, a couple of days ago now, New Zealand Herald published an article on their website that was essentially a direct copy of a recent Family First campaign targeting trans youth in bathrooms at schools, and offered very little, if any, counterpoint in this article to the claims that Family First were making. In fact, they didn't even really mention that it was a Family First campaign until most of the way through the article. It was mostly fear-mongering.
You know, yeah, people were branding it quite a regressive kind of piece of hate speech.
Yes.
Yeah. So trans youth represent one of the most kind of at-risk groups in New Zealand. A study was published by Auckland University which approximated that nearly 40% of transgender students had significant depressive symptoms and nearly half had self-harmed in the previous 12 months. And one in five transgender students has attempted suicide. What do you have to say about the statistics?
Obviously, they're horrendous, and as other studies have shown, these statistics can be improved in a supportive environment for these transgender youth. The issue with this Family First campaign is that it is drumming up unfounded fear-mongering, and that has not only a direct impact on the views of non-trans people, but it also can affect the mental health of trans youth if they, you know, they see these horrible and untrue things being said about them in the mainstream media like this. It's not going to be great for their mental health. As we saw in the US with Donald Trump being elected, just the possibility of things getting worse there for transgender people has had an adverse effect on mental health and suicide rates there.
Mm.
So obviously these kinds of debates being dragged out like this is quite irresponsible on the mainstream media's part.
Yeah, I did very much enjoy your commentary about the whole thing on Twitter. It was very kind of astute and reasoned, but you know, it very much does bring up that whole trouble of giving these kinds of harmful articles more exposure. So can you counter this?
Well, there needs to be some kind of counter-argument to this. Like, if we'd just left it alone, then there wouldn't have been any voices against it, and it would have seemed like implicit support from the silence.
Mm.
You know, just sitting back and watching bullying occurring is pretty much implicit support of said bullying.
Mm. You know, I also saw an article, there was no kind of counterpoint represented. Did you see who the article was written by? Was there a byline?
No, there was no byline, which again increases my concern that it was directly written for the New Zealand Herald by Family First.
The Herald is kind of notorious for publishing a lot of controversial sort of viewpoints. Have you seen anything similar to this in regards to not just trans youth, but, you know, in terms of gender or any other prominent issues?
Not quite in the same way, in that generally these sorts of things are clearly marked as opinion pieces, and, you know, there will be some kind of counterpiece from someone else. But in this particular case, it was labelled as any other news article on the site and presented as such. And, yeah, didn't have a byline, barely mentioned that the video in the article was produced as part of a Family First campaign.
Mm.
The Herald has since updated the article to include opinions from Rainbow Youth and other trans advocates, but this occurred, I think, the morning after the article went up, and by that time it had already been widely distributed on the internet. It's all over Family First's website as positive coverage of them and their campaign, and it's already done its damage. So any kind of later modification to the article is not really going to help.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was my producer, Joe Guy, speaking to Megan Bowerdine. And I'm sorry, my hand slipped and I played the interview too early. So, Joe Guy, do you want to explain a bit of the context around that interview and what kind of went down?
Yeah, so Megan basically very kindly explained that the New Zealand Herald copped a lot of flack for publishing what some are deeming a transphobic article. This is where a Kiwi teen spoke out about her school's decision to allow a transgender student to use the girls' bathroom, and yeah, the piece has come under fire for undermining journalistic integrity and promoting harmful speech. So that's what that was.
Yeah, awesome. We'll be back after this with our weekly chat with Andrew Little.
Right, hopefully that'll be enough. Do you have the wires connected to your brain, Leroy?
Sure do, Bruce.
Good. Let's fire this bad boy up and get you connected to Think Outside the Koru. All going to plan. You'll know all the greatest new music as soon as it's released. You set, mate?
Yeah, Bruce, flick the switch.
Come on, Leroy. Speak to me, mate.
Kane and the Karate Chops will release their new single, Tana Umanga, on Thursday.
Leroy! Leroy, mate! Leroy!
Don't put safety in your own hands. Listen to Totally Wired each Saturday, 12 to 2, for the best new music out there with your number one cool guy, OSH-approved host, Alex, every Saturday on The B.
Bye.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Kia ora, you're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM with Pearl. I have on the line Labour Party leader Andrew Little. Hi Andrew, how are you?
Hi Pearl, good to have you.
I'm good, thanks. So this week the Mana Party and the Māori Party announced they have signed an agreement to work together up until this year's general election. On RNZ's morning report, you criticised the Mana Māori deal, saying it's not kaupapa Māori. Do you stand by these comments?
Absolutely. The Māori Party has shackled itself to the National Party for roughly the last 10 years, possibly longer. They have been a support party to the National Party in government for all the time that it has been in government. They've claimed to be an independent voice for Māori in Parliament. They are not, never have been. Mana is signing up to that. The Mana Party is becoming just another sub-branch of the National Party as a consequence.
What about initiatives that have been implemented under National, such as Pepe Pods, Breakfast in Schools and a New Zealand Wars Recognition Day, to name a few? Do you not believe these initiatives have had a positive impact for Māori?
I look at what's happening with unemployment, Māori unemployment in particular. Māori youth unemployment is the highest it's ever been. I look at what's happening in housing. It is an absolute utter disgrace what is happening in housing, especially for Māori. Māori home ownership is now down to 25%. It has fallen significantly since National has been in government. It has never been this bad before. When we had the homelessness inquiry last year, the Labour and the Greens, the Māori Party wished to come on board. Manama Fox got on it. She came on board. She promised that she would take the recommendations of the inquiry to the highest levels of the National government. We heard nothing since, and the housing situation and homelessness has got worse. You know, Māori people deserve better, and it's not good enough just to have a party that claims to be an independent voice and there's nothing to show for it. I look at the seven Māori Labour MPs and some of the candidates we've got lined up to come in after this election. I see a very strong advocacy for Māori interests and for Māori needs, for Māori policy. That is way better than anything that the Māori Party, with or without Hone Haruere and Mana, can offer.
Yeah, because you said that Labour has more to offer Māori than the Māori Party does. Is this not reductive in the sense that it assumes all Māori have the same interests?
I've yet to meet Māori who don't think that there is a major problem with the low level of Māori home ownership or quality of housing, or are not concerned about the over-representation of Māori in things like homelessness and unemployment and the criminal justice statistics. All Māori are concerned about that. You've actually got to do something about it, not kind of just talk about it and claim that you're somehow a special independent voice but don't want to do anything.
And obviously there's been a bit of backlash from the Māori Party in relation to the comments. Do you think this is going to jeopardise your chances of working with the Māori Party to potentially form a government later in the year?
Well, I'm not expecting that will happen. The Māori Party has effectively become the Māori branch of the National Party. They are totally hitched their wagon to the National Party. I look to the wisdom and insight and intelligence and advocacy that Labour Māori MPs offer, and we've got everything that we need, that Māori needs, the Māori community needs, and those MPs, and you know, they'll be a very strong, very important part of a future Labour government.
Moving on, it was announced a couple of days ago that the living wage will go up 40 cents to $20.20 per hour. Do you support this?
I support the living wage campaign, and I support the need to lift wages generally. It's not possible, you know, given the current state of things, for that to happen overnight or in one fell swoop or by sort of central fiat. But the living wage campaign provides, you know, an absolutely vital benchmark. Yeah. And there's a growing number of employers who are saying, actually, the level of wages in New Zealand, particularly at the kind of low end, too low, ridiculously low, and there's a growing call for more to be done about that. But it's not something you can change overnight, as I say, the Living Wage campaign provides that important benchmark. It's about how far things are slipping for a large chunk of our workforce.
Yeah, do you think it maybe reflects a changing attitude towards the minimum wage as well?
There's no question the minimum wage is... You know, the minimum wage was only ever intended, and in fact only really used to apply to new entrants to the workforce, younger workers, to make sure that they weren't exploited as they sort of got into work and started their working lives. Truth is now, it applies, and this is one of the country's shames, It applies to workers of all kind of ages, skill levels, and so on in various industries. And that is wrong. So you look at the aged care industry, where you've got a whole heap of workers who are at or close to, you know, only just a little bit above the minimum wage for doing responsible and important work. And so we have to, we've got to change that. The pay equity claim that is being considered at the moment as a result of the Christine Bartlett case hopefully will lead to some change, but we've got to do a lot better. The government can provide some leadership in that, but actually it's got to be across the board, industry, employers, business generally. We've got to do the work to lift wages, particularly that sort of bottom end.
Yeah, last time, I mean, we just spoke a couple of weeks ago about the minimum wage increase, and I remember at the time you said you wouldn't legislate for a living wage at the moment, but there are a few building blocks that need to be put in place before you consider doing so. I mean, can you elaborate on what any of these building blocks would be?
It's about getting the union bargaining rights sorted out, you know, reinstating some of the important rules so that, you know, you don't have the situation where you have at the moment where an employer just decides on a whim that they've decided they've negotiated enough and they can walk away from bargaining. You can't have that. If you're gonna have bargaining right, you know, workers who join unions, that union membership is going to be meaningful, and collective bargaining is an important part of that, then you can't have it that employers elect to walk away. So you've got to change some of those rules around it. And then you've got to work with, you know, unions and employers and say, right, what is the pathway to lifting wages, and particularly, you know, focusing on those industries that are dominated by low-paid workers. Now, it is in New Zealand's interest for us to be lifting wages, lifting incomes, and not seeing the level of exploitation that we're seeing at the moment.
The Auckland Chamber of Commerce CEO Michael Barnett has criticised the living wage, saying it makes businesses go under and was just a cost that gets passed on to the consumer. What do you make of this?
Yeah, pretty old-fashioned thinking, actually. You know, the difference between more money going into the pockets of those on lower incomes compared to, you know, the alternative, which is usually tax breaks that favour the wealthy, is that those on lower incomes typically spend their money. The money goes into circulation that benefits local businesses, particularly, you know, things like your hairdressers, your retailers, and others. So I don't accept that kind of argument. And there may be some impact on cost, but actually, if we're lifting wages generally, lifting wages for all workers over time, then that is going to happen. But actually, people are going to afford more, and that's what you want. That's the way an economy works.
Cheers. Thank you for your time this week, Andrew, and I look forward to speaking to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Thank you. Bye. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was Labour Party leader Andrew Little for our weekly chat. My producer Joe Guy has a story up next.
Thing on everyone's lips this week is none other than Three's new current affairs venture, the Project New Zealand. Since 2015, the channel has produced many short-lived projects, and exactly none of them have managed to impress viewers. I spoke to spin-off editor and television critic Duncan Grieve to learn more about what the show means for the state of journalism. So, ever since the departure of our dear friend John Campbell from 3's coveted 7pm slot, virtually every show that's come to replace it hasn't lasted more than a few months. I think Story was the longest at about a year. So, Duncan Grieve, is the Project New Zealand our saviour?
I think it's the best thing that's gone into this slot, as much as I love Come Dine With Me New Zealand, and felt like it was unnecessarily thrown to the wolves. It wasn't really a long-term viable solution there. So the project kind of feels fit for purpose and different to what we currently have, and modern in a way that the previous occupants haven't. And, you know, I think there's nothing certain, particularly at MediaWorks, which just has this kind of insane churn going, but I think it has the best shot of anything we've seen lately at filling that void, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously the show's gone for a more sort of conversational approach, with the 7-day-style banter replacing hard-hitting news, which has worked in its favour for the most part, but it's also brought up this question about the current state of journalism. Do you think, you know, has chatting about the news replaced reporting on it?
I mean, it is, like that's undeniably what the sort of the function of the show is. I suppose what their counter-argument, and I have a lot of sympathy for this, is that, you know, audiences kind of have, they do essentially vote with their remotes, and in this era where the actual, where your access to reporting, if reporting is what you want, is essentially constant and infinite via the internet, you sort of need to do or to offer something different on television, particularly if you're seeking, as TV3 is, or as 3 is, a younger demographic. And that sort of conversations about the news can actually be quite helpful and illuminating in a way that sort of regurgitating the events of the day, which you might well already be privy to, might be less functional.
So do you think rather than it coming down to the adoption of like a privatized media model which places profit above knowledge, it's more just that audiences are kind of rejecting this sort of hard news?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot of kind of sort of people who are sort of strong advocates of public service broadcasting tend to have analyses of the state of journalism or the media that tends to critique it as a sort of, as the problem with, is the profit motive. I mean, to me, like, you can get extraordinarily good news products that are motivated by profit and incredibly bad ones which are motivated by nothing more than a desire to serve, you know. Like, I think the interesting thing for me has long been that MediaWorks and TV3 has had, I think by any objective measure, a better and more sort of fierce news product for decades now than TVNZ, you know, which has nominally got more of a mandate to deliver public service journalism. And yet MediaWorks is a privately owned company and currently private equity owned company. And so I think, you know, they're certainly not mutually exclusive. There'll be a lot of people, you know, I think especially older people who would look at a product like The Project and think that, and only see its flaws, only see the way it differs from what they imagine as a sort of golden age or idyllic vision of current affairs. And you know, like, you probably wouldn't design a show like The Project, you know, if all things be equal, but they're just not equal at the moment. You know, we live in a completely different era from both an audience appetite and a news distribution techniques than the one which preceded it. And so expecting the same product to go out in the same way and have the same impact is, you know, to my mind, is farcically dumb.
And yeah, like you said, this new approach, this kind of more fresher, more youthful approach definitely does have its merits, and combining elements like news, commentary and comedy has proved a recipe for success with things like Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show. But yeah, The Project New Zealand just hasn't sort of figured out that balance yet, both tonally and pacing wise. It's still a little shaky. Would you agree?
I agree. Well, I think it's different to those shows. I mean, and in some ways that's like, The Project's probably made by, I don't know, 10 or 12 people, and, you know, The Daily Show had a staff of over 100. So, and it was reporting on America, you know, which is just orders of magnitude meatier as a subject. So, you know, to a certain extent it's a function of resource and subject matter. I also think The Daily Show sucked when it started, you know, and the Project is actually, to a certain extent, by virtue of it being kind of a copy of an Australian format, which also sucked when it started and took a while to get going, it started probably as well as any current affairs show in recent memory, to my mind. Whether it can elevate from here, who knows? But I think it's come out well. Yes, it's shaky. I think it does have sort of tonal issues, particularly moving between serious and lighter subject. But I think they've got the casting right. Like, I really, Kanua Lloyd in particular, I have huge hopes for. I think she kind of, she just has this ability to get emotionally engaged with subjects and bring kind of personal perspectives in a kind of a sort of an unaffected, non-contrived way that I think feels new, and I think she'll continue to do that. Jesse, because he comes from a comedic background but also is a Radio New Zealand host, you know, he has a similar kind of balancing two different worlds, and Josh Thompson's just a deeply strange guy. And, you know, I think that, you know, that the chemistry of them and then whoever the fourth is, assuming that they can get a good sort of group there, you know, it has a, you just look at what's happening on TVNZ and you know, with the sort of, you know, the cynicism of Mike Hosking and the general kind of nothing to see here style of reporting or topic choices that that Seven Sharp pushes, and the fact that, you know, the project, for regardless of what you might think of it stylistically, it is for the most part, viral videos aside, engaged with the actual events that matter and have happened that day, that it's not afraid of politics. The same way Seven Sharp is. I think that, yeah, these are, you know, if you scratch the surface of all that behind the kind of e-news style of presentation, there's something there.
And like, as with most franchises, obviously the New Zealand version of anything is gonna cop that direct comparison to the Australian version. So do you think we're kind of missing that astute political commentary that's so famous with the Australian version of the project? Do you think we should be trying to emulate them directly, or trying to figure out our own vibe?
I think having politics in it is really critical. I don't think it should be particularly, you know, ideally it won't be a sort of a partisan thing. But I think to shy away from that, from political commentary, would be a mistake. I think that's what Seven Sharp, and to a lesser extent Story, really missed, was the sense of their current affairs that was terrified of mentioning, you know, the government or the opposition. And so, you know, they'll grow into that. Like, that stuff is hard, getting it right. But, yeah, I have every confidence in them to do that. The thing is, we're talking about a show that's 3 days old, and it often takes years before people figure out exactly who they are and how it'll work. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, so kind of early on in its run, it has also seen a few cases of what some might call lazy journalism. Like, last night's episode saw the show using stories and caravans from Campbell Live being branded as their own Christchurch earthquake coverage. I think Pip Keane tweeted something about that yesterday, and rather than sending out their own reporter, they used this other footage. So what's sort of happened to the deeply personal venture of investigative journalism?
I mean, what's happened is there's just, like, there's journalism's good journalism is expensive, and the media has been absolutely savaged financially. I, on one level, I totally get where Pippa's coming from. You know, it must be hard seeing stories that you sweated on that got, you know, being kind of repackaged into something else. On another, you know, Pip and John work at Radio New Zealand now, where there is only one imperative, which is deliver great journalism to the widest possible audience. You know, they don't have they've got financial constraints in terms of the frozen budget, but they don't have financial constraints in terms of the company being shut down if they get it wrong or can't sell ads. So, you know, that's a bigger problem and a bigger issue, and one that any individual show can't possibly hope to solve. You'd love to think that they will be resourced to do investigative journalism, but realistically, I think it probably, even in terms of the format, wouldn't necessarily fit. But even if they just sort of look out into the world, you know, the broader journalistic world, and when there has been fantastic investigative journalism done, they can help elevate it and discuss it and, you know, credit the journalists and organisations that have done it and, you know, bring it to a wider audience that might not necessarily seek it out themselves. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think there's this, the problem is that slot will be haunted for a while yet by the spectre of John Campbell and Campbell Live and the work that those guys did. And so if you're narrowly comparing it to what they were able to do, not all the time, because Campbell Live had its share of, you know, wacky stories, silly, irrelevant stories, so people forget that, but it also had some of the best, most kind of emotionally resonant and engaged reporting that you'll ever see. And I don't think that's going to happen on the project for the most part, just because it doesn't, you know, work or hold up on that narrow comparative scale doesn't mean that it lacks for function or worth in a broader sense.
And, you know, just lastly, I think this is the most important question. You've got Shortland Street producing Television Gold over on TV2 every other week. I mean, poor Harry Warner's just been put in the most vulnerable of positions with cliffhangers like that. How is the project meant to compete? Can it compete?
I think it can. You know, like, I'm a TV critic. I write a review. I review a program, almost always a New Zealand program, for the Herald every week and have done for over 2 years now. And honestly, quite rare for me to watch a show and go, I'd really like to watch a second episode of that, you know?
Yeah.
Like I sometimes do, like much more frequently don't. But with the project, I knew there was a sense of relief. There's this New Zealand show that's on five nights a week that is news adjacent, if not sort of hardcore news, that will be somewhere between pleasant and electrifying to watch on a nightly basis, and where I'm really curious about how the hosts will develop and the style and tone will develop. And that, you know, that's rare, especially for a nightly show to have that kind of, to have that, I genuinely have that reaction. You know, I put it on series link, I don't do that. So it's going to get criticized for being news light, for being a product of its era, that people will see other malign intent in that. But, you know, the things that it's less good at are endemic in this era, and their societal and journalistic problems that one entity can't possibly solve. But the things that it's good at are actually really worthwhile. And if people just viewed it as an entity in and of itself rather than as a Campbell Live replacement, I think all but the most extreme people would have to grudgingly admit that.
Around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was my producer, Joe Guy, speaking to Duncan Grieve about the state of current affairs with TV3's new venture, The Project. We'll be back after this.
Feeling down in the mouth? Your lust turned to rust? Hold up, and tune into the Rockin' Pneumonia Radio Show every Friday night from 11 p.m. till 1 a.m. Relieves instantaneously and cures
lameness,
feverish chills,
stereo and rabies,
funnel vision,
Naruto,
lockjaw and scabies,
shivering shakes,
neurosis,
broken rhythm bound,
chattering knees,
square skull syndrome,
bleeding gums and monkey thumbs. Yes, folks, the Rockin' Pneumonia Radio Show cures all ailments and woes.
Listen in every Friday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. to get your fix with hosts Loretta Swade and Johnny Moondog. It's the world famous guaranteed wonder cure.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
This is the fucking news.
The Wire.
Auckland collective Faf Swag has a series of projects happening this week as part of the Pride Festival. The projects aim to highlight and celebrate the local Pacific LGBTQ community. One event happening tonight will be the screening of an audiovisual art piece by local artist JC Tanuvasa. The work tackles issues of media coverage around transgender hate crimes around the world, such as the shootings of Candace Capri in Arizona and Amber Monroe in Detroit. In particular, it focuses on the problems of misrepresentation and misgender during a news coverage. News director Shemena spoke to Tanuvasa yesterday for a bit more detail about some of the main ideas in the piece.
My piece, Water Meadows in Wanzer, it basically is a piece about celebrating trans lives. But as much as I, being my authentic self and seeing girls living their authentic selves as well, as much as that's a celebration, we also have to realize that there's a lot more that we need to do within society for equality. And so I am addressing those things such as like the hate crimes that have been happening to colored trans girls around the world, and I want to address those issues in the clip as well as celebrate. So as much as I want to celebrate, we also have a long way to go, and so part of my activism as a trans activist, I address some of these issues that I feel like we need to get over in order to come down and have like peace and harmony and live in equality.
So I watched your piece, and I thought it was really beautiful. I noticed that you use a lot of kind of clips from the media in terms of expressing the ideas that you're trying to portray. Do you feel like the media has a huge role to play in kind of these issues that you're addressing in your piece?
Yeah, I think so, because the media has this issue of constantly misgendering trans identities. And it's coming from, for me, a transphobic perspective, or like a transphobic writer. Because if you had any respect, you'd write in the articles or address these trans women as the identity that they want to address as, which is pronouns female woman. And so when these injustice things like kind of happen throughout the media, it encourages violence against girls such as myself, and it encourages a community and a generation to continue misgendering us, which is real unfair, especially if you're in an article because you've suffered discrimination and then that's how you were addressed. Like, that's almost like a punch to the face, or even worse. And so the reason why I wanted to put things, snippets of people speaking about trans lives, both negative and positive, is because I wanted to kind of address all of these outlets that's been happening, which in my mind are problematic. And so, and then having this trans person as well speaking in my video, having her speaking on these topics and issues, for me, corrects the other voiceovers that I'm using. And I think it's really important that 2017 we start correcting people on their faults, because it's not right.
Yeah. Mm. Absolutely, because I mean, when I was watching it, I sort of thought about how the media, it's almost a double-edged sword, right? That there's positives and negatives. On the one hand, you know, it helps to expose that these hate crimes are happening against the trans community, but then at the same time, there are also like terrible sort of barriers around misrepresentation and misreporting, and as you said, like misgendering the transgender community. So is that sort of something as well that you feel is the issue around the media?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I feel like when you expose our trans identities and these hate crimes and you don't do it in a way that respects our identities, it just puts our communities in an unsafe position. Like, one, it could trigger young people, especially in their mental health, and then you never know that it could turn into something real terrible, like, you know, they could jump into suicide thoughts or depression. And so these kind of like ways of approaching our issues, I think there needs to be some type of positive method where like you address it, but then you don't, you know, keep pondering on this thought that we went through this hate crime and let's misgender them and let's show, like, you know, them in this bad light, where if we say this is what happened, but this is what we can do now to prevent things like this happening, then that puts us in a better perspective, and we end up feeling safe, because when you continue this, the way that the media has been going, we will feel unsafe in this world and how the world is going to perceive us, and we will feel unsafe when, like, our identity in itself, just because of how we're treated in the media. Because as much as we don't want to be, we can validate ourselves and we don't need anyone to validate our identity. We are who we are. But we live in a society that is real pressuring and tells us how they feel about us. And if they continue telling us in this negative light how we should feel, how we are and who we are, that can take a toll on an individual, especially if we're not as strong, especially if you're a young person trying to go through this transition and find your authentic self. So I think, basically this is how I'm feeling about the entire thing, and that's why I addressed it all inside my visual arts piece.
Mm. And so also, I noticed in your piece that there's really beautiful music that accompanies it. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yes, so the first half, I just wanted a sound that brings you into my mind and my body and how I feel. And then the second half, I use a cultural song, but because I like to come from a decolonized perspective, and I know that our language has been colonized and it's been changed over the years, and to the point where I've almost, like, our community kind of forgets what our Samoan language sounds like. And so what I did in a previous work, I asked these two singers that I had worked with if they could not do the lyrics, but somehow sing the song, either if it's from a hum, but with an open mouth, but not using any lyrics, because that piece in particular that I used previously was about, like, you know, the colonization and all of that. So in my head, I wanted to embody this decolonized sound, and I decided to not use any of our language and just use the tone and the real old school kind of sound. And the reason why I wanted to go for this decolonized vibe is because back in like pre-colonial times in our culture, for finger in our modern day terms, transgender identity, so we were all one. We were accepted. We were classified as beautiful just as much as the next girl and guy. And so me using this track is trying to remind people that our identities were beautiful and are still beautiful. And I want you guys to come back to our decolonized mindset. And then you would realize, and through the histories of our ancestors, that these authentic identities deserve just as much to be on this planet and, you know, living in our truths and our lives rather than been stoned upon and frowned upon and all of that stuff. And so that's why I wanted to use that particular sound and that particular piece at that particular moment that I use it at, just to validate the culture and then these Fafafine identities and trans identities and just make it really beautiful because that's what we are.
Absolutely. I think it tied it all together really quite eloquently.
Thank you.
And so finally, where can people see it?
So mine's at my piece is on Thursday from 8 to 10 at the AUT St. Paul's studio. So it's on one of the big buildings there. I don't think you'd be missing it. There'll be like a bunch of beautiful trans girls running around and probably wearing beautiful outfits and doing the most. So yeah, so if you can't find the building, find the beautiful individuals.
The Wire.
That was our news director, Ximena, on a piece about the Auckland Collective, Faswags, and their art projects happening as part of the Pride Festival. If you want to see Tanuvasa's piece, as she said, you can go to St. Paul Street Gallery in AU10 from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. tonight. I definitely recommend checking it out. We're going to be back after this. This is Angel Olsen with Fly on Your Wall.
It wasn't mine. I went along for the ride. I was a fly on your wall to see the heart of it all.
You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was Angel Olsen. Ports of Auckland has a firm focus on becoming New Zealand's most sustainable port. They've come a step closer to acquiring this title by introducing LED floodlights on site. 95BFM's Dylan Kelly spoke to Matt Ball of Ports of Auckland to find out the benefits of the new lights and whether or not they have any new emerging technologies to achieve their carbon neutral goal by 2025.
The biggest measurable change we'll see will be a decrease in our power usage, so electricity usage. LED lights use a lot less power than the standard lights that we've got in there, and I forget what the name of that is, but we will save so much power just from the lighting. It'll take 7% off our electricity usage just in the first stage, and the second stage should give us a similar amount in savings. Then there are other benefits as well, so we get a better quality of light at ground level, which improves safety. We'll have changes in the frequency we have to maintain the light, so they last 75,000 hours. They won't need to be changed for a number of years compared to the lights we've got there at the moment.
The idea with floodlights is that you turn them off in the day and then on at night, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So they're not on all the time, they're only on during hours of darkness. The great thing about these lights though is they don't need to warm up when you turn them on, so they come on instantly, and if anyone's got LED lights in their home, it's exactly that sort of turn on, and that means we can do cool things like dim the lights in future. So if there's no one working in an area, we could just dim those lights right down, so that cuts down on light pollution and saves power use. And you can do really cool things like if you have a van or a vehicle driving through the port, we could, once we've done the whole port, fit sensors to all the lights so that only the areas that van is driving in get lit just before they get to the area. So you're really targeting the light at where you need it.
That's awesome. Do you know if you guys are the first in the world to be doing this, or are you going off someone else's model? Or
We haven't looked overseas. I'm sure there's LED in use at other ports. I mean, we've got LED here on the port on our machines and in some of our sheds and in the offices and things. We think we're the first in New Zealand to do it, and that's because the technology for the floodlights has really only just hit the point where it's got the reliability, the light quality at ground level, and the durability to cope with a harsh port environment with all that salt and spray and wind.
Right, and I see the Ports of Auckland wishes to be the most sustainable port in New Zealand. Do you have any other exciting emerging technologies that may help bring this change?
Yeah, no, we've got a very much a sustainability drive. In the past, we've had a number of sort of environmental initiatives, but they've been quite ad hoc, basically depending on who ever within the port thought this is a great project to do for the environment. But with sustainability, it's a much broader focus. So that, of course, involves being sustainable economically, having good relations with the community, and being a sustainable port in the central city, and being environmentally conscious and friendly as well, and good relations with staff, and all those sort of good sustainability measures. We've set ourselves some pretty hard targets, particularly around emissions. So we want to be carbon neutral by 2025, and then we have quite a stretch target of by 2040 becoming emissions free. Now, if you think of a port environment, you've got things like tugs, which rely heavily on diesel, and no one's invented yet a battery operated tug. So yes, we are going to have to be looking all around the world for the very best and latest in technology to achieve those targets. But we're thinking, well, why set an easy target? Why don't we set something hard and then really try and get to it? And if it takes us a bit longer, so be it. At least we gave it a good shot.
Can anyone explain why the modern day whales are so big?
The Wire.
That was 95BFM reporter Dylan Kelly speaking to Matt Ball from the Ports of Auckland.
That was The Wire.
It's also the end of our show for another week. Thank you to those who spoke with us for the show today: Megan Bauer-Dean, Andrew Little, Duncan Grieve, Matt Ball, and JC Tanavasa. Big thank you to my producer, Joe Guy. And of course, thank you to all the listeners for tuning into The Wire this week. This is actually my last Thursday Wire for the foreseeable future. I'm actually going to be on the Tuesday Wire next week, and then I'll be taking a break from The Wire. So thank you to everyone who's tuned into my show all these weeks. I really appreciate it. And I love hearing from you guys. Sigrid will be up next with the 1 to 4, so make sure you stick around for that. This track I'm going to leave you out with is Oh So You're Off I See by Kane Strang. Thanks, BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.